Thank you, Bill. Now it is my privilege to introduce our speaker. Her name is Shelley Jane. She is from Tulare. She goes to the St. John Episcopal Church, her home church. Her sober date is May 5th, 1990. Her favorite step is step two because she says that it changes things. Status quo. It's status quo, accepting your higher power. And so, with all due, here's Shelley, our speaker.
Evening, everybody. How are you all?
Hi, Shelley.
I'm Shelley, recovering alcoholic. It's a little backwards, right? I'm going to chime myself. I may hope you guys brought your sleeping bags. Wow, that was pretty impressive watching everybody get their chips tonight. Don't turn me up.
Oh, yes, no. Just a little bit here.
All right. This is kind of intimidating setup here. Yeah, I think I'll run now. Yeah, there's too many people in here. We're having a small group. Again, I'm Shelley, recovering alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be in this meeting sober by the grace and power of God. The 12 Steps to Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our program, it's a suggested program of recovery. No, I have to do it, but I found that if I followed the steps thoroughly, and you know in chapter 5 it says that twice in the reading, you know, we thoroughly follow our path, you know, and we can get somewhere doing this sobriety thing, you know, so I'm really... glad to be here, kind of impromptu, because I got about 2 days' notice. I see how Bill works. He tells you it's going to be like April sometime, you'll speak, right? And then he calls you 2 days later and says, I need you to speak tomorrow. I thought that works pretty good. So I checked my calendar, make sure that I'm not doing something else and double booking or whatever. So it's good to be here. It's always on. I was always told we never say no just to service work, and we never say no when someone asks you to step up to the bat and share your experience, strength, and hope with other people who need to hear your message of recovery. And I've seen a lot of people do a lot of service work, and I always look at the people that have to get all those leads because I say, don't people keep telling you no or don't show up and all that? And I thought, nah, that's a tough job. I can't do that. So, you know, those who do get speakers for meetings, you know, my hat goes off to you. It's kind of a tougher part of service work. But anyway, I was trying to think of what I was going to say on the way here. My first thought was, oh, no, not my past. I gotta talk about all that drunk I did. But, you know, it got me here. And that's the only purpose that it served. It was really worth it, was that it did get me into the rooms. I had a lot of chaos and drama in my life. And, wow, that was 11,617 days ago that I started making my only because you guys have helped me, because I couldn't have gotten this far. I mean, when you guys told me that I might have to make meetings for the rest of my life, I'm like, crazy. You know, what it say in the big book, it says we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. You know, and I watched people, you know, come and go, and those that didn't make it were those that didn't make meetings regularly. So here we are. And usually I have been on this meeting on Zoom. And I was just kind of thinking, God, that's a really funny way of getting me off of there. I'm from the kitchen behind the computer and into the reading, you know. And then on my way over here, I'm realizing, you know, I don't know where that church is. I know where it is on my app, but I don't know where it is. So I had to call and find out. You know how you circle the neighborhood, you still can't find the meeting. And then it's dark, so you can't see anybody walking to the meeting. So, you know, it's just complete. I'm disoriented, can't find the... And then it's usually, like, right behind you. Like, turn around. Oh, there we are, we're way there. So anyway, I did actually make it on time. So that's a miracle, because I'm the kind of alcoholic that usually doesn't make stuff on time, unless you pay me. Now you pay me, I'll be. That's called work, right? But anyway, I'm just grateful to be in the meeting. And I'll share the best that I can. I don't like going through a lot of my past, which, you know, at this point in the game, it's not fresh in my mind anymore. You know, I kind of listen to people in meetings, and it kind of jogs my memory. I'm like, oh, yeah, I went through that. And, oh, yeah, I did that, too. And, you know, all I remember is that it was bad. You know, I think I can remember back that far, and I didn't remember anything was good. I remember when I came to these meetings. People were laughing and having fun, and I thought, I don't see it. I just, nothing, you know, it's not a damn thing funny in my life right now. And I didn't want to stay, but it was suggested that I come. I think at that point I was starting to realize that God wanted me to understand the brevity of my situation, and that was that. Not that I just needed help, I need to admit that I was an alcoholic, and it was actually like a meeting where they were giving the chips out during the chips that I actually admitted that I was an alcoholic, because I was trying to get a family member sober, and I didn't know that was possible, you know, that wasn't possible. So I was actually kind of here like a family member, and then I started realizing that, you know, part of the reason why I'm in trouble with this family member is because I have the same problem. And that did it one day. I sat here and watched everybody picking up their tags, and I realized that I had stopped because there was so much chaos and drama going on in my own personal life that God had removed my desire to use so that I could stay alive and focus on the situation that I was in because it was life-threatening. So, and then I realized, well, I haven't been doing anything for a few 24 hours. And I was jealous that everybody that came up and got chips was getting chips, and I really deserved one. And I hadn't admitted that I was an alcoholic to come up and go get one. And finally I said, that's it, I'm too jealous. I got to get up here and admit that I'm an alcoholic, and then I was trying to stay sober to the best of my ability, but I needed help. So I came up, and I remember when they gave out chips, it was crazy. It was like a touchdown every time somebody came up here. So to see everybody lined up, getting hugs, you know, everybody showing up like that, and all the people that, you know, shake your hand, all that, that's what I remember, because we're really in the business of staying sober. That's why we're here. So we can't do that first. You know, we're really not here for the right reasons, you know. But, they say if drugs and alcohol don't kill you, the lifestyle will. And I was one of those people who had a lifestyle problem. And I was still functioning. I hadn't lost a house or, you know, cars or had DUIs or anything like that, but I stood in front of a lot of judges because of domestic violence issues, because I was with the wrong people. You know, my parents always warned me about being with the wrong people, right? How they say, if you sit in the barbershop, you're going to get haircut, right? So, you know, you keep hanging around with birds of a feather, it's locked together, and then, you know, you're going to get into the same problems that they got into. And sure enough, that happened to me. I didn't listen, and I just partied on the weekend. They tried to send me to college, and, you know, my parents thought it was going to be medicine, but I was majoring in what we call extracurricular activity. You know, Friday through Sunday, all I did was party, and then, you know, on Monday morning, it's like, oh, my God, I got to do the same. I'm not ready for it. So I really wasn't going to school for the right reason. And I was getting in a lot of trouble. I was, when I first came into recovery, I was living in Chicago. That's my hometown. I was born and raised there. And right about in the time of the 70s in Chicago was the big drug explosion. So a lot of cocaine was sweeping through, you know, the communities. You know, alcohol was always there. There's always a liquor store on every corner. No big deal. But my dad drank, so I wasn't very enthusiastic about drinking. At least not then, until, you know, they came up with wine coolers and stuff that looked a little more girly. So I, you know, wanted to drink that. So, but the drugs, it was starting to take people out. A lot of people were freebasing, and I started trying that, and I started realizing that I could get sucked in really, really fast. And because of that, I kept thinking, you know, who's going to take care of the kids? Because while we were doing that, you know, I had a son, and I mean, who's going to get him up in the morning and send him to school? And, you know, I don't think anybody in the room was doing that. You know, and a lot of my friends were, like, leaving for lunch breaks and not coming back to work. I'm like, you got to have jobs, guys, you know. I was kind of addict alcoholic. I'm going to keep my job because I got to protect my addiction. I got to have money to pay him for my addiction. So, I don't know. I don't think that was really smart, but it wasn't. I'm completely stupid. But anyway, you know, I finally reached the bottom where I found what I call my match, and that's the person who you get into a relationship who's worse off than you are, much worse. And I almost didn't get out of that situation alive. Thank God, where I had bought my home was around the corner from the police department, because if it hadn't, I know I wouldn't be standing here today. I'd be a statistic. And I had my 8-year-old son who would run around the corner and get the police and, you know, bring them back to the house because, you know, the crack addict I happened to be living with would snatch the cord out of the wall and want to beat me up. You know, I kept winding up in domestic violence shelters, kind of trying to figure out what's wrong with my life, you know. And I asked my higher power when I got to recovery, why did things go this way? And he showed me this really weird way, like a vision of two people playing cards. And he was sitting across from me playing cards. He put a card down. I looked, you know, at the card, and it said alcoholism. And I thought, what? It's not in a deck of cards. But I think that was his way of showing it very clearly to me that that's what the problem was. And then when I thought about it, well, you know, as a little girl, I would go, you know, with my dad on Saturdays when he ran errands, and he would pick up at least 5 cases of Budweiser. And they, I mean, they had to roll it out on the horse, guys, and load it into the back of his car. I guess he's one of those customers. But he always had several bags of, like, Jack Daniels, and he drank, and he isolated. So I really knew what alcoholism was all about. I just didn't know it from the perspective of an AA member, like I just said. But I saw it growing up, and my dad was very, very mean. He was atheistic. He didn't believe in God. So, and today I still fight those, that thinking, because I was raised by him, you know, and he taught me to be self-sufficient. His education was his God, and he didn't believe in a higher source, so to speak. But then as I kind of dug around in recovery to find answers, I learned that his dad had been murdered when he was very young, and it was right after he had taken him to the South to visit his grandparents, and after he left and went up north, he got killed. So I think my dad was really bitter about losing his father, you know, and probably drank because of that. You know, what could have happened in his life if things had been different? So, and I hated my dad because he was the alcoholic, and he was controlling and mean, and, you know, he would come out and pick on people. He was very mean to my mother, and she was very codependent. So, you know, long story short, I grew up in a dysfunctional alcoholic home. And so you get trained how to be an alcoholic like that. My dad smoked, so I learned to smoke. He drank, I learned to drink. I thought I'd never drink the hard liquor. Eventually I did, you know, made it up to hard liquor. I did everything my parents did. Then on the other side, my mom, codependent, so I learned how to give up my rights, my personal rights. I learned how to live someone else's dream in their shadow. I learned how to do all that stuff. I learned how to not communicate because we didn't talk about anything. We didn't want my dad to hear what was going on because she had to do a lot of damage control with him. So it was really chaotic. But what I learned, too, was that one day the crack addict in my life told me, you know, there's a place, Shelly, you can go get help. And I thought, nah, he didn't say that. Like, what do you mean? Well, you know, if somebody's selling everything in the house and, you know, going out on these 5 or 6 day benders right after payday, of course, when the bills need to be paid, and would show up for a while and then come home with these deranged looks on their face, haven't shaven and washed up for 5 days, all the money is gone, and angry and mean, I thought, yeah, yes, he's got a problem, but he never did anything in front of me. He would leave and disappear, you know. And, well, I won't say he didn't do anything. A lot of our belongings came up missing, including, you know, the wedding band with the diamonds in it and the classic card my dad had given him because he trusted him. You know, it just got progressively worse. I remember one time trying to get money out of the bank and find out, you know, the bank account was zero, but, you know, I don't know where he got my passcodes or whatever, but he cleaned out my bank account, and the next day all my checks were bouncing around town. So, you know, he did motivate me to get help, and I thought I could change him, but, you know, it comes to a point and place where you start looking at what's your part in this. Even if you're an alcoholic, you're not in recovery yet. I mean, you're going to wind up looking at what part of my life is feeding into this. So when you told me there was a place to go get help, I pretty much had enough by that point. And so I went and got the help. And then I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because I started realizing that, you know, my problem was, you know, the reason why I was there wasn't so much what he was doing. It didn't matter. But you guys told me how to detach, you know, start looking at my own life and start cleaning up my side of the street, you know, so I got a sponsor and a poor lady or my very first sponsor had been in the program probably around 5-7 years, somewhere in there, and she had a sponsor. She needed one with me. And she would have me come over to her house. She had a big lane there, and she had a Webster's, and she had coffee on, you know. And we sat down and started working the steps. And I remember that first day that I left after reading step one with her. It was like something just, bam, immediately. My life just went from 0 to 100 unmanageability. It was being just served up in my face, and I thought, what is going on here, you know? But I was fine till I went to my sponsor's house. But, you know, what no one told me was that, you know, actually your sponsor guides you through the steps, but you are working the steps with God, your higher power. So immediately when he saw you, you know, me read and made the commitment to work step one, he started serving up that unmanageability, like, buffet. And I remember just, I mean, after 3 or 4 days, oh, I was fit to be tired. Everything I said, put my hands to, try to manage or take it, none of that stuff worked. And I remember plopping down on the couch and saying, you know what, I'm not going to say nothing. I'm not going to do nothing. And the family, just for an hour, they walked back and forth, you know, in the living room looking at me like, are you okay? I wouldn't even say yes or no. Just leave me alone. They leave and they come back. Are you sure you're all right? Don't ask me nothing. No, don't tell me that. No, I want to do nothing. I just sat there and surrendered. Wait, Lord. You know, but God just wanted me to see that, you know, my life was unmanageable and that I had to surrender. So, you know, immediately that's step two. And I mentioned that the reason why I liked step two was because that was when things started to change. You know, I got a higher power of my understanding, and actually that higher power was the one I had from childhood. And I realized in the program that I grew up in a lot of spiritual confusion, mainly because my parents sent me to church and not take me to church. Because there were, you know, churches in the community like this where you could walk to, and I guess they needed a Sunday babysitter, so they got rid of us and made us go to church. And that's what we did. So I learned about God in church, but I didn't learn with the help of my parents. So when I came home, I saw them arguing and being mean to one another, and my mom looking all unfulfilled, my dad, you know, with this drama and stuff. And I was thinking, you know, why are they sending me to church? But then when I come home, they were being really mean to each other, and why wouldn't they go? And, you know, so I lived in spiritual confusion. You know, the only God that I knew was what I had learned in church, which, thank God, I went to the little Sunday school classes. And I think my first encounter with unconditional love was when I went and they told me that I needed to, after Sunday school, I needed to stay. And I'm like, why? They said, well, we want you to sing in the choir. And I'm like, sing in the choir? And they slapped this little red choir robe on me. And I was nervous because, one, I didn't know the songs, and two, they didn't know I couldn't sing. So I went up there nervous, shaking like a leaf. But what I realized was it didn't matter to them that I couldn't sing. It didn't matter if I knew the song. They just wanted me to be a part of. And that was my first encounter with unconditional love. You know, they just wanted me for me, you know. And I sat there, you know, year after year, singing in that little choir with the red robe. Long story short, that was my understanding of God. You know, the people were really kind there. And I kicked God to the curb after high school, right? Like most people do, start going to college. And I don't need church. I don't need none of that stuff. And my life took a nosedive for the next 10 years. And so wind up living with a crack addict, right? So never stopped going to church. But anyway, just imagine we're all sitting here on a Wednesday night at church, right? God gets his way anyway. So for me, I realized when I went back and got in an environment like AA and felt the nurturing of people, unconditional love and all that again, that, oh, this is a place where God is, or people that like God are here, you know. And that's my encounter. I remember thinking that, oh, that's what's missing in my life, that peace I used to feel as a little kid. So then I started to realize what God really was. God is the peace that I had on the inside, and I wanted that back. And then you guys started introducing me to a higher power, and I thought, well, I'm going to go back and get the one I used to have, because he was pretty good to me, right? And up until when I kicked him to the curb, of course. But, you know, then I realized, too, that he just took care of me despite everything I did after I left him. So now I know that God doesn't leave me, I leave him. And I've done a lot of things in the program and service, and I've had sponsors, needless to say, and I've made meetings. I worked all 12 of those steps with my sponsor, and I had apprehension about working some of the steps, especially step 4. So, you know, step 3 is easy. It's just a matter of willingness and turning your will and life over to the care of God, which I saw after sitting in these rooms, listening to all of you guys and how good things were getting to you. I'm like, you know, I want what they have. So I stayed around and I did exactly what you told me to do. I made the meetings. I did the 90 and 90. I got the sponsor, started working the steps. I wrote things down in my step 4 inventory. I even went to therapy because they told me, living in that situation I was in, Shelley, you're on the verge of a nervous breakdown. Run. Don't walk to the closest emergency room and the doctors evaluate you. I did that too, and immediately they got out the pad and started writing me a prescription. Crazy. Yeah, she needs this. Major depression. But I'm glad they did, because I was on the verge of a breakdown, and that, see how you guys saved me from that. I stayed on antidepressants and stuff for 10 years. I had to, because they said it was more important that I take those medicines than stay at home under my blanket. So if I needed that to get up and have the energy to work my recovery, then I needed to take them. So I took them, but I was grateful that AA guided me in that direction. Then AA told me, you know, get a higher power, Shelly, really start, you know, improving your relationship with them. So, you know, I did a lot of praying. Of course, the first prayers that I really started praying were, you know, the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. So I'm still grateful today that when I don't have the willingness to pray, you guys still make me pray at least twice a day, you know. Serenity Prayer at the beginning of the meeting and Lord's Prayer at the end of the meeting. So, but I did learn to do more praying and meditating. I made those amends. I didn't want to make them after I wrote those lists down, all those people. I couldn't face them, all the stuff I had done. And especially one particular college instructor that I did really bad after this woman had done so much to help me get through college on drugs, right? And I had to go back. It was years, but I went back and finally found her and made an amends to her. But, you know, my sponsor said, Shelly, you know, if you don't have the willingness to make the amends, just pray and ask God to give you courage. So that's what I did. And, you know, I only needed courage for the very first person I made amends to, because after that, I was like, wow, that came out pretty good. You know, now, you know, me and that person were friends again. It was kind of like, you know, the relationship had got restored. So I made the decision, you know, this really isn't that bad an idea. I think I'll just go ahead and keep making amends. So I didn't need my courage after that. I just needed to complete, you know, the program and keep being willing. So, and most of all, honest, too. That's another principle of this program. If you're not honest with yourself, all your junk that you've done, if you're not honest with yourself about your problem, if you're not honest with yourself about your life and the way it's going, and especially, you know, the first 4 months, I remember sitting in the rooms, because I didn't think you guys were sober. I thought you were lying about it, because I was supposed to be lying to me about stuff. So I always looked to see if someone was going to pull something out or roll something up or pop something or something during, before, or after the meeting. And I kept looking. This went on for 4 months, and then one day it hit me. I said, these people are serious about staying sober. I mean, are. So then I was able to get the focus off of you guys and start getting the focus off, well, do you really want to try to attempt to do this? But today I will say, like, just when I first came many years ago, you know, I do this program. I get up every morning. I don't know how today is going to roll out. I don't know how God's going to keep me sober. I just pray and ask him to do that for me and to guide me in my life. I'm real good at bad decisions. Real good at that. And I need God to make a difference in my life when it comes to bad decisions, people I know, situations that I get in. A lot of times, I, you know, I'm a runner, so I don't want to stick with anything too long, you know. But God has taught me how to finish a few things, and I did finally get out of college. And I feel sorry for my dad. He paid cash for about 8 years of me wasting a lot of his time, and I did finally get out. But he taught me how not to give up on people. And then I realized when I made my amends and I started looking at my relationship with my dad, you know, I think I was really his favorite. And that was why he kept shelling out the money and putting up with me. And the day I graduated, he lit up about 5 Webers full of barbecue, and he invited 50 people over to the house. I don't know if that was an insult or a blessing, but he had all those people come over to celebrate, but she finally made it. But, you know, my alcohol abuse actually put a lot of that I worked for in jeopardy. And today I have to remember that I can lose it all on one game of pitch and toss. You know, I can make one bad decision. I can pick up that first drink and it'll be all over. And I can lie about it, because maybe you guys won't be standing in front of me when I do that. But I can't lie to me. And God's always watching, you know. So I don't really get away with anything. I just prolong it, you know. So today, honesty is critical in this program. And it is so that I can live a better quality of life. When I lie to myself, I'm usually not willing to fix anything or deal with anything. So I have to make sure that I'm being honest with myself, and that works pretty good for me today. So, you know, in the end, I want to say that I'm glad that people asked me to come and share about where recovery has taken me. It's been quite a journey these last years have been. And I mean, sometimes things get up and down, but when I look at my life from when I started with AA, it's been pretty much uphill. You know, I even look at my Social Security, that yearly statement they send you, and I've noticed that after I got through all the rough spots in recovery, from then on I was consistently employed, and my salary slowly grew, you know, and my opportunities grew, you know, and I've done a lot of things since then. I never thought that I would be an author, but one day my higher power intervened. I would take my little journals to meetings with me and write down stuff that people said that was wisdom for me. And stuff that I was like, why didn't I think of that? You know, I'd write it down, or someone say something in a meeting that was a solution to my problem, I would write. So I did a lot of writing in recovery. And I had all these journals on the top of my bookshelf. One day God just said to me, Shelly, you're already an author. You just haven't published. And I never looked at it like that. So I went to a class, took a class. And the next thing I knew, I published my first book on the day that I found out my dad died. So, being willing, you know, but I wanted to call them. Actually, I called them that day, and nobody answered, and I know why. It's because my sister was probably at the hospital, and I didn't stop there. I started publishing in general and published other people's books and started writing about my passion, which is to see people healed and whole, you know. And I still do that. To me, Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful opportunity to just help people find out what wholeness is all about and how to rebound from no matter what situation you're in. You know, the promises say no matter how far down, you know, the scale we have gone, you know. And AA, it can fix anybody, you know. I've seen people that struggle to get this program, and people that I look down like, never make it. They'll never make it, you know. And then one day, bam, they'll get it, and they want to make all the coffee and show up at the meeting. I'm like, wow, where'd that come from? That come from just not giving up on people. You know, we're not disposable. So anybody in here that's struggling, if you keep getting up and coming back to these meetings, you're going to achieve what everybody around you is. It's going to rub off on you. You're going to get that AA haircut. So, I don't want anybody to be discouraged. You know, it doesn't matter what you've gone through. I've seen people that one guy I talked to, he had murdered his dad when he was a teenager. They got into a terrible argument, wound up going to prison. And he did so well in prison because he was an AA member. He wound up getting more and more grace until eventually they let him out. So I don't think there's anything impossible, you know. And he said to me after that, he said, Shelly, he said, remember step 9, you know, you want to make sure that you restore other people. After you've hurt and harmed them, except when to do so would injure them or others. But after you've hurt and harmed them, you know, when you restore others, that's when you get restored. That's why after step 9 it says that, you know, then you enter into the world of the spirit. Because now, you know, you've cleaned up your inner road. There's no fault. You know, your slate is clean. And now you enter a spiritual life. Not our wildest, you know, imaginations, and that's what, you know, recovery has been to me, you know. Today, I think the greatest gift I have, too, is having that open channel, the higher power, you know, having that Wi-Fi to God, that's what I like to call it, you know, and making sure it's always, like, online, and making sure that I listen, because I didn't know that God was talking to me, you know, when I was doing everything wrong. But then when I look back on, I knew that I heard this from the inside, but I didn't know it was God. Maybe I would have listened a little harder if I'd have known it was God. But today, it has taught me how to listen to God, and not just listen, but respond. So that's the hard part, you know. That means I got, you know, like it says, that ego has to be smashed. That means I'm not willing to do it my way anymore. I'm willing to do what God says. Every day I wake up, I always draw a line down my 10th step. I say, God, this is my rendition, what I'm going to do today. But, you know, I do want to consult you and ask you, what do you think I should do? And you know what he did? He had someone, the young lady, call me today and remind me that I had to speak tonight. So, you know, God won't let you get out of the things that he really wants you to do. And I was just busy at work, and I hadn't thought about what I was going to do after work. But, you know, he made sure that I got reminded of the commitment that I made tonight to come in and talk to you guys. So no matter where you're at, I believe if you have faith in God, just believe that he can keep you sober. You know, I found out if I just asked him and let the day unfold, it would happen. And I remember someone saying in a lead they were giving that they were thinking about relapse. And they were sitting on a bus contemplating how they were going to go and you know, relapse. And right when the bus got to the red light, they saw a person walking down the street that they had seen in the meetings and realized that she was that person was walking to a local meeting. And they made the decision while the bus was at the red light to hop off and to go follow that lady to the meeting. So you just never know how God, you know, will get you through that day and get you right back on track, you know. So if you make a serious commitment that you want recovery, God said, good, I'm glad you're on board now, and I can make that happen for you. But if you have any reservations, now's the time to take a look at them, talk to somebody about them, ask yourself why you would want to go back, you know, and then make a decision that nothing back there is worth having, and everything in front of you is. So I'm going to close with that. Thank you guys for listening to me.